red light and green light.
Please proceed.
And I understand that both sides are agreeable to this panel.
We are, Your Honor.
Okay. And Mr. Dixon, you're up first for Ms. Schwartz.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Bob Dickerson, and I have the pleasure of appearing here today on behalf of Abigail Schwartz, who, as Your Honor noted, is in the courtroom. Thank you very much for having us and giving us this time. I've requested your clerk, I told her I would like some rebuttal time, and it's my understanding there's going to be an indication at about 5 minutes, and then I can take it from there. Your Honors, there are five issues that are before the court today. I want to address the ones that I think are the most important, and that is the first two. I am not ignoring the last three, and if I have time, I do intend to go into the last three, but I think my concentration is really on the first two issues that are raised in the briefs. Give you a little background on this case. These are parties that were married in January of 1993. At the time of their marriage, Milton Schwartz was 71 years old, and Abigail was 41, so we have a 30-year difference in age between these parties. They were divorced 14 years later. The findings of facts and conclusions of the law of Judge Ritchie indicate 13 years, but it is 14 years is the term of their marriage. At the time of their divorce, Milton Schwartz is 85 years old, and Abigail is 55. Abigail today, I believe, is 59 years old. The difficulty of this case arises that less than 8 months after the decree of divorce was entered, Milton Schwartz passed away, which is very critical, I suggest, to the issue on the alimony, which is the second issue I will discuss today. This case involves, during the term of their marriage, prior to their marriage, the parties entered into a premarital agreement, and after their marriage, there were five additional agreements that were entered into by the parties. Interestingly, and I can't explain why they were termed the way they were, but two of those five agreements were, one was entitled Amendment to Premarital Agreement, and another was entitled Addendum to Premarital Agreement, and then there was a Reconciliation Agreement, and then there was an Addendum to Reconciliation Agreement, and second Addendum to Reconciliation Agreement. Quite frankly, I think all the agreements pertain to the same issues, and why they gave them different names, I have no clue. But the two agreements that I think really are critical to the first issue is the Addendum to Reconciliation Agreement that was entered into by the parties on April 9th of 1997. And then I think we also, in order to interpret that one, we need to look at the second Addendum to Reconciliation Agreement that was entered into by the parties on October 1st of 1999. And those two agreements are of the record. They're pages 189 through 194 of the Record on Appeal. The pertinent agreement that deals with the life insurance policy is a provision that the relevant provision reads like this. I don't know if you can see it from the floor, but I wanted to highlight really the significant relevant terms.
Sure, go ahead.
I don't know about my colleagues, but I can't see it at all. It might be best if you prop it up against one of your lights.
Do that.
How about it?
Well, Mr. Dickerson, isn't this quoted in the judge's order?
Yes,
so we can just refer to the judge's order? Can't
absolutely, but I wanted to focus on this language that I think really is the controlling language for the first issue on the life insurance policy. Now, I'd ask you to keep in mind that I believe that this is a question of law that is to be considered by this court on a de novo review. And I think that in order to do so, the two agreements that I mentioned need to be considered by the court. This relevant provision is a portion of paragraph F of the Addendum to Reconciliation Agreement that was signed by the parties on April 9th of 1997. And what's really important is the terms that they use here. Abigail shall be assigned an irrevocable interest as a beneficiary of an existing life insurance policy to secure her interest in Milton's estate as set forth in paragraph 8E of the premarital agreement. Abigail shall be the stated owner to the extent of her assigned interest in the policy. I think particularly important is the term that she is to be the stated owner.
Our position is that created a property right that cannot be taken away from. There is an assignment of an irrevocable interest, and she is the owner of the policy. The appellant in this case cites to language in that same paragraph of the addendum to reconciliation agreement. After this sentence is a provision that provides for Milton Schwartz to provide documentation to Abigail Schwartz on every 2 years for the purpose of confirming the size of this estate. The next sentence reads, all provisions of this paragraph shall only take effect if Milton should die while the parties are married and living together as husband and wife at the time of his death. That is the provision that the respondent relies on to say, this provision has no effect unless they are married at the time of his death. But if you take a look at this provision, he could not possibly assign an interest to her after his death. So it was a total impossibility to do it any other way. And this provision, I suggest you, has to be read in a way that makes logical sense as to how it could be established. And you could only at the time that he entered in that agreement could he assign to her the life insurance policy, and she in turn, as the owner of that policy, could make herself the irrevocable beneficiary.
But didn't Mr. Schwartz testify that the purpose of that clause was to operate as collateral or security for the payment of the accruing obligations, and the trial judge accepted his testimony as credible on that explanation?
His testimony, as I recall, was that this provision was drafted because Mrs. Schwartz was concerned with having to deal with his children at the time of his death. So the concept was to provide her with this life insurance policy. So I'll be the first to admit there is such ambiguity in this, because you take a look at it and it speaks in terms of securing her interest under subparagraph under 8E of the premarital agreement. Now, I think what's important is we get to the next agreement that the two of them entered into on October 1st of 1999. Did I respond to your question? I don't think he said that it was...
Here's the question I have for both counsel, I have at least on this point. The judge in his decree concludes that the agreements are clear and unambiguous.
With respect to this one, Your Honor, he determined that there was an ambiguity.
Well, I was just going to say, except this one. And in reconciling or resolving this ambiguity, he relies on Shelton, which I think seems reasonable, for searching for an interpretation. And he concludes on pages 5 and 6 of the decree that he accepts Mr. Schwartz's testimony as credible as to the purpose in reconciling the ambiguity.
Correct.
We are to review this under an abuse of discretion. What is it about that conclusion by the trial judge that constitutes an abuse of discretion?
I suggest to you that it is a question of law, the interpretation of this agreement. And as a question of law, you would review it de novo. And reviewing it de novo, that's why I asked you to take a look at these two agreements, this agreement and the very next one in line. Mm-hmm. Because you take a look at this, and it's pretty simple to understand. Owner is a property interest. You can't take away that ownership interest from her, and it could never be taken away. The point is, however, is that when Mr. Schwartz signed this, he didn't assign any interest to her. There was no assignment
let's assume for the moment that we accept your contention about what the interpretation was. What's been assigned? The underlying race is still an accruing interest, which the judge said in clear and unambiguous terms was only payable when Mr. Schwartz died. So even if there's an assigned policy, the amount wasn't specified. It was only for the accruing payments, and those would never be vested.
See, at the point in time that they entered in this agreement, his estate roughly was in the neighborhood of roughly $3.3 to $3.5 million. At that point in time, he should have assigned a policy to her worth $3.3 to $3.5 million. She would be the owner of that policy. He could never take away any of those rights from her. The agreement provided...
Seems to be at odds, though, with the other provisions in the agreement that says that he only takes if he's alive, I mean, if he is deceased, excuse me.
It does, if you read those together, but I think you're looking at two different issues that are raised that they were attempting to...
So you view this provision here as completely separable from the separate party agreement?
Right. Now, let me tell you where we get to that. We get to the next agreement, which is the second addendum to reconciliation agreement that was signed by the parties October 1, 1999. Very important. The first paragraph in that says, we're talking about paragraph F of the agreement I just read to you. All it says, paragraph F to the addendum to reconciliation agreement dated April 9, 1997 is hereby amended to provide that Milton shall furnish Abigail with a reevaluation of his net worth every January, commencing January 2000. There is no mention in there that we're taking away the insurance policy. There's no mention in there of anything other than when he has to give her the evaluation. Then it goes on, and it says paragraph 8 of the reconciliation agreement is hereby clarified as follows. And then it goes through a provision as to how she would be paid based upon the size of his estate. It doesn't say we are revoking, we are taking away the provisions of the life insurance, and more importantly, nowhere in that agreement does it say that she is only going to get this 10% if they are married at the time of his death and they're living together at the time of his death. The final provision there says, the terms hereof are intended to clarify certain provisions of certain prior agreements between the parties. To the extent there is any inconsistency between the terms hereof and the prior agreements between the parties, the terms hereof shall control. Again, this agreement makes no reference or no provision that they must be married at the time of their divorce and they must be living together.
Mr. Dickerson, I just one other question. I apologize on this point, but your approach to paragraph F seems to bump up against the language in the very last sentence of paragraph F of the addendum to reconciliation agreement, which states, this addendum shall not modify, revoke, or supersede any of the language set forth in the reconciliation agreement. Doesn't your interpretation, which I understand to say, creates some independent vested claim to a $3 million plus policy, bump up against the provisions in the reconciliation agreement?
I interpret that more with respect to how he is going to divide his accounting, but the next agreement in line doesn't make reference to that. The next agreement provides that the terms of this agreement, the one that is subsequently entered into, shall control, and any inconsistencies with the previous agreements are to be controlled by this agreement. So again, what it boils down to is we believe that it created a property right and that she was entitled to that property right, and it could not be divested just simply because Milton Schwartz decides that a few months before the 10th anniversary he's going to file for divorce. The second issue that I believe is critical, and the one that if you take a look at this court's decision in Daniel versus Baker, this case is so much on point with Daniel versus Baker. Judge Ritchie determined that it wasn't, and he tried to distinguish it. But keep in mind, we're dealing with a 14-year marriage, 85-year-old husband, 55-year-old wife, and there's 30 years difference. I think what's also important in considering this issue is that we take a look at the record on appeal. There is a handwritten note from Milton Schwartz that is at the record on appeal starting at 1380. And at the bottom of 1382 to 1383, Milton Schwartz wrote this to Abigail Schwartz before their marriage. It says, you may occasionally work should you so desire and keep the money. However, your work cannot interfere with our plans to travel or make you tired. The record before the court shows also that since 1992, Abigail has not worked and that she had problems with her feet that prevented her from standing, and that is the reason she could not go back into nursing. Now, as I mentioned, the case authority that's relevant here is Daniel versus Baker and Sergeant versus Sergeant.
Well, I think you're, I was going to ask counsel to comment on this, because there wasn't a lot of time devoted to this sentence in the briefs. The Daniel case, people are distinguishing, even the judge did, over the facts of the case. But what Daniel says on page 14, 414, there's a sentence that really hasn't been discussed much. At the time of the divorce, Tom, who was much older than Carol, was in poor health and had a much shorter life expectancy than Carol. That seems to set the test that a judge is supposed to employ when deciding on lump sum alimony versus term or installment alimony.
I couldn't agree with you more.
And so your argument on appeal is that the judge abused his discretion by not focusing on that sentence, as opposed to focusing on the factual difference between Carol and Abigail's financial condition.
Absolutely. And in this case, we were dealing, that case dealt with a 15-year marriage. We're dealing with a 14-year marriage. That case dealt with a 20-year difference between the parties. At the time, it was the husband was 78 years old. We're dealing with an 85-year-old.
I have one other question while we're on the point. The judge did award alimony. It was installment.
Which ended approximately 7 months later.
What would the dollar, I didn't calculate this. That is still, even the amount he awarded, though, would have been, if he had lump summed that amount, have you calculated what
it
that would
be? It would be $60,000 a year for
seven years,
and I don't know if he wants to put a present value to that. But our problem with
what I don't understand, Mr. Dickerson, how did you, what was the basis for your contention that lump sum should have been 2.9 or whatever?
Because we were asking the court, we provided the court with documentation, her financial affidavit showing that her monthly living expenses were $25,000. She was asking for a $35,000 alimony award based upon the standard of living that they had grown accustomed to during that.
So that's how you arrived at the lump sum. Okay, I'm sorry, I just didn't follow the math.
But
if the judge had applied that test and awarded lump sum, assuming there was no abuse of discretion in the amount he set, which there doesn't seem to be a lot of talk about here.
We do address that. That Judge Ritchie himself, what he did is he cut her down from $25,000 a month to, I believe, about $13,000 a month.
Right.
And in doing that, he gave her $3,000 a month allowance for a home when she was already paying $5,000 for rent. There are a number of things that we address, and I'm sorry that my time is over.
I've read your brief, and I'm sure my colleagues have, along with the record. So I've read those schedules.
I just have a quick question about the alimony.
I have taken all of my time, so I get no rebuttal.
I'm going to give you some more time, and I'm going to give Mr. Berkley some extra time on this case, because we've asked you some questions. But I wanted to, was there discussion that since Milton was older and in poor health at the time of the divorce, that even if he passed away, that the alimony would still be in installments over the period of time?
We were asking for that. We had asked the judge to do a lump sum award, or at the very least, not have it terminate upon his death. And Judge Ritchie refused to do that.
Did he say why, especially that it would go, the installments would go on even if he passed?
He didn't. He made a comment along the lines that, yes, if he passed away, that it would affect the extravagance of her lifestyle, but he felt that she could still get along without that $5,000 support that he had ordered. Again, our position was that it should have been in the neighborhood of $25,000 a month.
Just
considering that he was making $4.9 million a year, that was our position.
Any questions, Justice Seda?
Yes,
Justice Sotomayor?
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dickerson. I'm going to give you 3 additional minutes for rebuttal. And Mr. Berkley, I'm going to give you 18 minutes so that each side has a sufficient time to present their case. So, if Harriet, if you did. Thanks. Time's 18 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Fred Berkley. I represent the respondent. Jonathan Schwartz is the personal representative of Milton Schwartz. I represented Mr. Schwartz through the negotiation and execution of all of these contracts, through the divorce and through the trial. Where to start? As the court has noticed, the poster that we saw
it gives you the first sentence or the first line of the addendum to the reconciliation agreement. If it had continued down and included the whole paragraph, it would have included the phrase, this provision shall only take effect if the parties are living together as husband and wife at the time of Milton's death.
But why did you use the words irrevocable and owner? I think that's what Mr. Dickerson was keying in on, the words irrevocable and owner to say that it was a property right. How do you go against that?
Well, the phrase, the condition that runs throughout all of the agreements up to and including this agreement is that it'll only take effect if the parties are living together as husband and wife at the time of Milton's death. That's in the premarital agreement that was drafted. It is in all the subsequent agreements that lead up to this agreement. The use of the word irrevocable was, well, the agreement was drafted by Abigail's attorney, Brad Richardson, admittedly reviewed by me. The court held, as a finding of fact, that the purpose of this agreement was to provide a mechanism to make sure that Abigail would get paid if the parties were living together as husband and wife at the time of Milton's death. Remember, Mr. Schwartz was under no obligation to leave anything to his wife at the time of his death. In the premarital agreement, he gives her a whole laundry list of things. Mrs. Schwartz entered the marriage, as I think the court knows, with assets worth about $30,000. She left the marriage with assets of approximately $4 million. Mr. Schwartz was always very generous. Mrs. Schwartz, during the course of the trial, volunteered that Mr. Schwartz was not only a very charitable individual, but was also always very generous with her. But the one thing that Mr. Schwartz insisted upon throughout the course of these operative agreements was that the only way in which Mr. Schwartz would have some type of interest in his estate is if the parties were living together as husband and wife at the time of his death. As a finding of fact, the court found that this language in the addendum was to be used as the mechanism. Life insurance was the mechanism by which Mrs. Schwartz would be paid so as to avoid any conflict with Mr. Schwartz's heirs. Mr. Schwartz has a number of children. He wanted to make sure that there was not going to be any problem or any hostility between the children and Mrs. Schwartz, and that is the purpose, and that is the finding that Judge Ritchie made, in his findings of fact. The next agreement, when Mr. Schwartz realized that there was not enough cash value in his insurance policies to pay Mrs. Schwartz, they had to look for another way, another mechanism by which Mrs. Schwartz could be paid if the parties were living together as husband and wife at the time of Mr. Schwartz's death. Hence, the second addendum to reconciliation agreement. The second addendum to reconciliation agreement was drafted solely by Jerome Blute, and it says in right within the agreement that Jerome Blute represents Abigail only as an advocate for her position. Jerry Blute drafted this second addendum to reconciliation agreement, which does not extinguish the condition that appears throughout all of the previous operative agreements, that the parties must be living together as husband and wife at the time of Mr. Schwartz's death. Admittedly, Mr. Schwartz did not make his wife the beneficiary of a life insurance policy. There was not sufficient cash value. So what he did instead was, through Jerry Blute, they negotiated a second addendum to reconciliation agreement, and the evidence at trial indicates that Mr. Schwartz was not represented by counsel, but be that as it may, there is nothing in the second addendum which would any way imply that this condition, which Mr. Schwartz had felt was so important throughout all his agreements, was somehow extinguished just because it was failed to be repeated in there. I think that with regard to this living together as husband and wife, Judge Ritchie really had no choice. I mean, it is clear that that was the intent of the parties throughout, and since the parties were not clearly living together as husband and wife, that he had no alternative but to deny that claim. Let me talk about alimony for a few minutes. With regard to the Daniel case, Daniel versus Baker, which Judge Ritchie obviously was aware of and obviously discussed in his findings of fact and conclusions of law, I think it's an understatement to say that it's factually distinguishable. In that case, the wife was not only 20 years younger than the husband, but she had an eighth grade education and was working in a bowling alley. I mean, I'm reading out of the first paragraph of Daniel versus Baker. Eighth grade education, working in a bowling alley. Mrs. Schwartz, the evidence shows, was a registered nurse.
had a Bachelor of Arts from the University of UNLV, attended 1 year of law school in Walnut Creek, California. According to the express terms of the premarital agreement, she was a sophisticated businesswoman with considerable business acumen. More importantly, she had $4 million worth of assets at the conclusion of this.
But the judge's decision to award alimony of $5,000 a month was not for rehabilitated alimony, which to me suggests that the facts on which you rely in Daniels are different. The question is the legal factors suggested in Daniels, where you have folks that have a disparate age difference, with Mr. Schwartz, as in Tom's case, having a much shorter life expectancy than the wife. And my question really is, when a trial judge is confronted with that kind of a situation, shouldn't they do more in the record in deciding to reject lump sum alimony? This, to me, is a legal question, not a sorting out of the facts between the two cases. Because if the purpose of the award of alimony in this case had been rehabilitative in nature, then I could understand the point you're making. One would say, well, how could that be? Because her income and Carol's is so different. But here, the purpose of the alimony was different. It was to recognize the difference in earning capacity and financial strength, of which it was substantial. So it was an award to bring about some lifestyle, maintenance of lifestyle. Seems to me that the judge then needs to focus on the age difference and health differences of the parties. And at least the court's order doesn't address that.
Well, in Judge Ritchie's 21-page findings of fact and conclusions of law, he focused on a number of issues with regard to alimony. What I think, however, is most significant is,
well,
he made a specific...
He may have gone for 21 pages, but he focused on pages 16 and 17 on the Daniels case.
Okay.
And he was absolutely correct. He recognized Daniel and he distinguished Daniel. But the distinction that he relied upon in Daniel is the same distinction on which you rely, which is the financial condition of the spouses in both cases.
Well, I certainly don't dispute the fact that, in my estimation, one of the factors that a court must look at in determining the alimony is the disparity in the age and the life expectancy of the parties. But I don't think that's the only factor that the courts must look at. Judge Ritchie actually made a finding of fact that Mr. Schwartz had more than sufficient assets and more than sufficient job skills to provide for her reasonable needs, and that alimony wasn't even necessary based on what her reasonable needs were.
I want to clarify one point. I'm sorry for interrupting you, but the judge did not say that Mr. Schwartz was in poor health. He said exactly the opposite. He was coming in every day, 5 days a week, attending to business, was alert in his findings, that's what he says.
That Mr. Schwartz was working 5 days a week? That's true.
As opposed to Tom, who was in poor health. And so there was some risk that Tom wouldn't be able to fulfill the installments. Here, apparently, Judge Ritchie felt Mr. Schwartz could.
Well, and the reason for that was, despite some of the remarks in the briefs, the only bit of medical evidence or health evidence at all during the course of the trial consisted of when I asked Mr. Schwartz, how is your health? And he says, I have renal failure, I have complete renal failure, and I'm on dialysis 3 days a week. That's it. There was not one stitch of medical testimony other than that at the trial. And counsel can certainly point out when he has his time if there is, but there's not. There were no doctors. In fact, even Mrs. Schwartz, a registered nurse, never testified to word one about Mr. Schwartz's health being failing. Now, all of a sudden, we see in the reply brief that Mr. Schwartz had days to live or weeks to live. Well, that was nonsense. Yes, Mr. Schwartz was 85 years of age, but he certainly was not aware of the fact that 7 months later he would pass away. I think it's a little bit of a bootstrap argument to say, aha, we were right. The only medical evidence, in fact, not even medical evidence, the only evidence at all at trial of Mr. Schwartz's health was, Mr. Schwartz testified that when I asked him, I have renal failure and I have dialysis 3 days a week, but I'm working 5 days a week, which, again, went uncontroverted. Judge Ritchie obviously couldn't make any other findings because there was no medical evidence that he was he had come into court and he was on his last legs, or he only had days or weeks or months to live. That's something that didn't come into this case until we got the reply brief. Judge Ritchie, when he made his findings, made a specific finding that Mrs. Schwartz had sufficient funds just with the amount of money she could make on her investments and what she could earn if she would go back to work to more than adequately provide for herself. He decided to go even over and give her $5,000 a month to support some of the more extravagant lifestyles that she testified to. And with regard to extravagant lifestyles, let me mention this. Mr. Schwartz did come before the court originally and asked for $35,000 per month. By the time of trial, she filed an affidavit of financial condition, which is in the record, which reduced her request to $25,000 a month. But even at $25,000 a month, she had a number of categories which were so outrageous that Judge Ritchie decided to go through them one by one and give what he felt was a more reasonable amount of expenses. Mr. Schwartz testified that Mrs. Schwartz never spent the kinds of monies that she had in her affidavit of financial condition. She actually came before the court asking for $10,000 for clothing a month, for $2,000 for hair and makeup a month. I mean, these amounts not only were overly extravagant, there was no evidence for them. I asked Mrs. Schwartz, do you have a single receipt, a single document, a single credit card receipt, something, anything which would show us that this is the lifestyle you say you were maintaining with Mr. Schwartz? She had nothing. She produced no evidence that she spent anywhere near $35,000 or even $25,000 per month for her care. Judge Ritchie, I think to his credit, was very generous in going through the various categories, coming to an amount that he felt was reasonable expenses, made a finding that she could meet those expenses with her current income level and her current assets, and then said, but just because of the disparity in income, I am going to award her $5,000 a month for 7 years. And as the court has pointed out, even if there had been a lump sum alimony, what we're talking about is 7 years at $5,000 a month is $420,000, less the seven payments that Milton made before his death. So what we're really talking about is $385,000, and not $3 or $4 million as is being asked for in this appeal. Not that we think $385,000 is an appropriate amount as well, but the facts in Daniel and the facts in Sargent versus Sargent, the other case that was relied upon in terms of the lump sum alimony, are so far different from the instant case that Judge Ritchie, we believe, exercised his discretion in a proper way and did not abuse his discretion.
Also, Daniel is like 1990, and it's going to be 2010 shortly. Don't you think we need to take a further look, a clarification as to the situation with Daniel when we're looking at people of affluence rather than people of, who are almost paupers?
I certainly do. I mean, I by no means, again, I'm not trying to back off from the fact that I can't help the fact that there's 30 years difference between these two folks. But we have a litigant, Mr. Schwartz, who has about $4 million, had $4 million at the conclusion of this divorce. She had job skills as a nurse, $4 million, at least 2.8 of which was liquid. She had a whole, she had lands and diamonds and became a wealthy woman as a result of this marriage. She herself admitted during the course of the marriage that she made an investment in real property, and as a result of that investment in real property, she made a large amount of money, a number of millions of dollars. She testified and admitted during the course of the trial that Mr. Schwartz helped her through that investment, loaned her the money so she could make that investment, and even forgave a portion of the debt to her. She testified that Mr. Schwartz was a very charitable, and I realize I'm repeating myself, and generous individual. It seems to me that she has just not been left in a situation at this point where she can't fend for herself, as the spouses were in Daniel versus Baker and in Sargent versus Sargent. I think those are more than factual distinctions. I think really in terms of weighing the various factors, although disparity in age is one of them, I think actual need and the financial situation in which the wife is left it certainly are equal factors and must be looked at. And in this case, they certainly militate toward the award that was made by Judge Ritchie. I would also point out, although we have not raised it on appeal, and I certainly wouldn't be raising it here for the first time, there is language in the premarital agreement that we felt should be read to be a waiver of alimony. We felt that no alimony should have been awarded because it had been waived in the premarital agreement. It was not waived as clearly as I would have liked, unfortunately, and Judge Ritchie held against us on that particular issue, and we'll certainly live with that issue. But the premarital agreement does say, and I'm paraphrasing here, that all of the rights and all of the gifts and various transfers of property that Mrs. Schwartz was receiving was in lieu of any other claim she might have to property or support. That word support was used. I think, in my estimation, and I realize I'm an advocate in this matter, but in my estimation, we felt that Judge Ritchie was very generous towards Mrs. Schwartz in terms of the award that he made. He could have certainly said that she is not someone who's in need of alimony. She's got about $4 million, most of which is liquid. He didn't. In order to address the disparity in the wealth of the two individuals, he gave her $5,000 extra a month, which he talked about having her use for things like travel and discretionary type expenses. It is clear, I think, from the findings of fact that he bent over backwards. He also awarded her $25,000 in attorney's fees, which certainly was not something that she needed. I mean, she certainly had sufficient funds to pay her attorney. She required my client to pay her $25,000, which is one half of the attorney's fees that Mr. Dickerson represented in his closing argument that she would incur, $50,000. We feel that there really is no basis for any of the issues raised on appeal.
Let me just ask one question. It seems like this is on the alimony issue. It's a could have. It could have been denied completely under your factual scenario. Under Mr. Dickerson's factual scenario, it could have been lump sum. How do we answer it as an appellate court so that we instruct the family lawyers in this state as to how to handle this situation when you're dealing with someone with the age disparity, the health issue, because it is an issue, and the fact that we're talking about affluence here? You could have argued, and I guess you didn't argue against alimony, period. You didn't say that that she doesn't need any alimony, and under these cases, under Buchanan, Sargent, et cetera, that alimony is unnecessary. How do you answer that could have, the could have?
I answer it this way. I think this court should say, and I'm not presuming to tell this court what to do, but I think the answer should be the trial judge is in the best position to weigh the credibility of the parties, to view the parties, to take into account all of the facts and circumstances. This court, in my estimation, should be very wary and has often said that you do not want to substitute your judgment for that of Judge Ritchie. This is a case where you are required to use, and it is acknowledged in the briefs, abuse of discretion as the standard. In this case, I think you say that Judge Ritchie viewed the parties. Judge Ritchie had taken into account all of the facts and circumstances. I don't think this is a case in which you can fault Judge Ritchie for having abused his discretion. If this case had come before any one of you when you were district court judges, and you may have decided differently, that's not the standard. The standard is, did Judge Ritchie somehow abuse his discretion merely based on the fact that there's a 30-year age gap? We don't think there is.
Thank you, Mr. Berkley. Mr. Dickerson, you have 3 minutes in rebuttal.
In Daniel versus Baker, the Supreme Court determined that there was an abuse of discretion and remanded to the district court and ordered that an appropriate award of lump sum alimony be ordered. This case, I suggest, needs to be either done the same way or this court establish what that amount should be. I anticipate that more likely the proper way is to probably remand it for that determination. But we take a look at Judge Ritchie's order. We can complain about the $5,000 a month, but he determined that this woman needed support for 7 years. That support lasted for less than 8 months. So even taking that portion itself is the realizing that this woman needed support for a period of 7 years, his whole order is negated by the fact that the gentleman passed away within an 8-month period. This is exactly the type of case that Daniels is. Daniels, there was a 20-year age difference. Daniel, this is 30 years. The husband in that case at the time of trial was 78. Mr. Schwartz was 85. The wife in Daniels was 58, and Mrs. Schwartz is 55 at the time. 15-year marriage versus 14. Poor health. You're right. Judge Ritchie didn't mention the poor health. Yet, the testimony by Mr. Schwartz himself, questioned by his counsel, okay, do you suffer from any health issues? Answer, I have end-stage renal disease. My kidneys don't work. Question, okay, and as a result, do you receive any treatment? Answer, yes, dialysis. Question, and how often do you go to dialysis? Answer, 3 times a week. As we set out in our reply brief, end-stage renal disorder is terminal. It's end-stage. It's exactly right there what the condition is. Fortunately, these are on videotape. I doubt whether you get the videotape, but you could see the health that this man was in. He was in very poor health. So to order something to last until this man was 92 years old didn't make a lot of sense unless we somehow secured it and protected it. Much has been said about what Mrs. Schwartz's lifestyle was. We put together a financial affidavit that showed her monthly expenses is $25,000, $5,000 of which was the rent on her home. Mr. Schwartz's affidavit, which is at the record on appeal at 519, his monthly expenses were $19,956, and his house was paid for. So you add an additional $5,000 to him, and they are spending the same amount. So why Mr. Schwartz, at 85 years old, why should his wife be treated any differently? It's a lifestyle issue. And that's what our position is that she should have been awarded an appropriate award of spousal support that would allow her to live in that station of life. This case boils down very simply to what is fair and equitable, and as the result that we see, it's not fair and equitable, and we would ask you to rule accordingly.
Thank you very much. This case will stand submitted, and I just wanted to say to both lawyers, I've known both of you since you've been admitted, and I expected a fine argument for both of you, and you both lived up to my expectations.